Welcome to the SJ Child Show. Thank you for all your continued support. You can find us at sjchilds.org. Enjoy the show.
Hi, and thank you for joining the SJ Child Show today. I am excited to start this conversation with someone who I have found in the community who is going to be a very interesting discussion, and then my words get all mixed together with me. And I wish that I would have had some guests maybe put together some questions that I could have asked you, but I just thought of that at the last second and thought, well, there's no way I could get all of the questions in time. So we'll cover enough information that to get everybody the great information. So thanks for being here. This is Sam Levine, and he is from, you are on the East Coast. I'm not quite sure where you're at though.
Thank you. And thank you so much for having me on your show. Yeah. It's such an honor and a pleasure to have this discussion, conversation, all the above with you, and to be able to contribute to the important work that you're doing in the community and beyond. So I teach at Touro Law School, T-O-U-R-O. It's a university in based in New York, although it's a worldwide university. And the law school is based in Long Island, or on Long Island, as people like to say, in New York State. And I'm a professor of law at Touro Law Center. I'm director of the Jewish Law Institute at the law school. And I've also initiated the Disability Rights and Inclusion Program.
Wow, that's incredible. And I am really interested to hear kind of what issues come up around those types of things so that, you know, we can get some really great steps to take for people out there that might decide someday that they need a special education attorney.
And, you know, you mentioned special education, and just before we started recording, we were having this conversation about special education and why it is that important to find a good attorney. And this is something I've learned in my work with numerous parents, children, individuals who have tried to navigate the special education world and the special education legal world, which is its very own unique area of the law. And like anything else, you have to find someone who is both competent and caring. I think that's what you're really looking for, no matter what type of help you need in any area of life, but in particular when it comes to special education law, where we're supposed to be focused, the school district's supposed to be focused on the best interests of the child, on educating children. But for all the reasons that we all know, that's not always the case, unfortunately, and sometimes tragically. So it really is that important to find a good lawyer. And every school district is different. Every state is different. And every district within that state is different. I know Long Island, for example, there are numerous, many, many different school districts. And it can make all the difference in how the district approaches you and your child's education. So absolutely. And for that reason, one of the areas that we're focused on in our Disability Rights and Inclusion Project is starting from the educational process, because that's where it all starts, of course. Mm-hmm. That's where, and related services, but it's the school system, the school district, and those related services that the districts are supposed to be providing, that they're responsible to provide, mm-hmm. At least in the K through 12 age range and grade range, and perhaps, you know, till a student age set at the age of 21. But that's an obligation. It's a legal obligation. There are federal statutes. There are state laws. And most of all, we kind of forget this. And sometimes in the heat of battle, we kind of miss the point on all sides, unfortunately. But I'm just so frustrated when I see school administrators who we would hope at least went into this position and this area of employment for the right reasons. Teachers who, you know, went in looking to help children, but over time things happen, and over time people become jaded. And once you reach that adversarial stage, sometimes they dig in their heels. And again, I don't have to tell you, you've been working in this area for so long, and many of your viewers, I'm sure, likewise. But that's what we're overcoming. That's what we're trying to work against. And sometimes as we say as lawyers, we recognize that as much as the adversarial system is a natural part of the process, it's also good to find a lawyer who can work with the school, who maybe can take that first step in a positive direction. And sometimes you can accomplish much more working with the school than trying to fight them.
No, I love that you said that, because that's one thing I advocate and try to teach about so much is building that team, the IEPU team, the advocacy team, your doctors, your therapists and teachers all together. That's what's going to make the best a situation for your child or student at the time, you know, building those relationships. And that's hard. Parents don't understand that that's something that is something they should set a goal for. And it is a measurable one, you know, and that's something also they don't see the benefits of. And so I hope that we can share that with them, that not only can you put all of these people in a team together, you can have, and like you said, a special education attorney be part of that team with you.
And I like that notion of a team, that vision of having a team. One of the programs we're trying to implement, still in the early stages, but we have a special education clinic at Touro Law School. As I mentioned, Touro is part of a wider university. So we're trying to build this interdisciplinary team where we include some of the experts in different branches of Touro University. We can have an OT, a PT, a speech therapist, a psychologist, someone who's adept at other areas, and it's that interdisciplinary. Yeah, it's a fancy word we use. It's a technical word we use. But what we really mean is we're looking at the whole child. We're looking at the whole person. And none of us is just one aspect. None of us is just, and schools, unfortunately, sometimes try that piecemeal approach. Okay, we'll give the student some extra time for their exam. Okay, we'll let the student go to resource room here and there. Okay, that's not, in my view, the way to really provide the supports and structures that the student needs to survive and to thrive in that school setting. It really does take, it's the cliche, it takes a village, but it really takes a team.
Yeah.
And it takes that type of local village where everyone is working together, and it has to all be about the child. It can't be about that fight between parents or about a lawyer, and the school has their own lawyer. And once you get off track in that direction, it's hard to get back on track.
Isn't that the truth? No, I can see that in many areas, not only in education, but in any areas that you have to go down that route. So that is for sure. You know, and it's so important that as parents, we go into any and all, you know, communications with professional services with, number one, the right mindset is the most important, but number two, all of the information we can give. And the more we can share and communicate what our child's support needs are, then, you know, maybe we can find better systems to put into place. Because like you said, it can't just be a couple ideas here and there. It needs to be systems in place, feet on the ground, you know, kind of an attitude and actions taken in the school.
I think so. I think that's exactly right. And I think that's why when we talk about an IEP, an individualized education program, it has to really be individualized, directed at this particular student, this individual. That's why we call it that.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, again, like anything else, we're all aware of how things work in the real world. And particularly now when you have these computer programs where you have the boilerplate. So many IEPs start from the point, okay, we press this button and we say the student needs this type of support and we'll provide, quote unquote, this type of progress. And in reality, it takes a lot more than a computer program, a boilerplate, just some sort of, you know, preset fill in the blanks to actually maintain and produce progress.
You know, let's discuss and maybe break down the difference between an IEP and a 504 so that some of our new listeners or new parents that are like, what are you talking about? You know, they haven't gotten in, they're still in early intervention programs and they haven't entered into the school systems yet. So let's talk about what those are and how those differ.
So I'm actually not a special ed attorney. I appreciate that. So I could give you my understanding of the two, but I would,
Sure.
strongly recommend in that sense approaching a special ed attorney.
Okay.
Fair enough, but I am involved in trying to bring about that kind of big picture
Yeah.
approach. So I'm involved in putting together the team. I work with our special ed attorneys, but
Okay.
I think it's an important point to make that as much as I'm an attorney and I'm knowledgeable about these areas, I would recommend, strongly recommend to your listeners that if they have a legal case, they should make sure that they're going to an attorney who says to you, I can tell you this like the back of my hand. This is not something, and again, I'm knowledgeable about these areas, but not comfortable
Yeah.
providing legal advice and not comfortable providing that particular degree of guidance. The same way I'm a criminal law professor, I was a prosecutor. I know criminal law pretty well. If someone had a criminal law case, I would say, you know what, you have to go to your local attorney who's familiar with the way the criminal justice system works in that area. And likewise,
Yeah.
when it comes to the school districts, as I mentioned, every school district is different. Some school districts are really entrenched and they'll send their lawyers and just refuse anything you say. And some districts are open to working with you and with your attorney. And it's your attorney who has to know the difference and has to know what strategy to take that are in your child's best interest.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's wonderful. And I can put links to kind of an informational guide, if you will, that I have a great place that you can just look up those definitions for those things. So it's so great when we have an idea of who we can turn to in the community, because once again, it's like this black hole that sometimes when we're on this island of being as far as for our family, all autistic. And so sometimes it feels like, boy, the outside world, the community, the grocery store, the everywhere, they just don't really get us. So we're out there trying to, make a difference, show who we are. But having the ability to look for someone you need in the moment of real help, and it is so important. And like I had told you, like having a good attorney that you know in your local area is hands down the best thing you can do, just for future anythings, right? It's kind of like insurance.
Absolutely. And I mentioned criminal law just as it's one of my areas, but hopefully that won't be the case that none of you will need a criminal lawyer. But you never know. You never know what happens. Things can go wrong. But certainly more commonly, if you're filing your taxes and you have some questions, you'll go to a good tax attorney. If you buy a house, you'll go to an attorney who knows how to do a closing. And you won't go to someone who may be an amazing corporate attorney, but doesn't know the first thing about house closings. It's just not the way to go about it. And I sometimes make the analogy to doctors. You'll go to a specialist, you might go to a general practitioner for some sort of basic type of advice, a checkup, that kind of thing. But once there's something more specialized, you go to a specialist. And you go to a specialist who's up on the latest technology, up on the latest research. And when it comes to the law, things do change. And everyone is different, and every school and school district can be different, and principals change, and superintendents change, and that can make all the difference in educational process.
Yeah, definitely. Where do you tell people to start? What's a good starting point?
So there are clinics like our clinic at Touro Law School. Throughout the country, many law schools have special education clinics. There are other public interest organizations, legal aid societies, and the like, whatever their name is. They're public interest organizations. Some law firms do pro bono, as we call it. They will provide services for free. Beyond that, special education has become a fairly prominent area of law. Because unfortunately, or fortunately, I guess it's fortunate that we're, fighting these fights. It's unfortunate we have to. But it's become very apparent that the school systems are not, in many cases, providing the type of education and the appropriate education that, again, is both mandated under law. And I think it's important for parents to have, as you mentioned, that mindset going in, because it's not just that they're looking out for their child, which is what obviously is first and foremost in their mind, but it's also the recognition, the mindset that they're not asking for something special. Mm-hmm. We use that term special education, special needs. And I know some people who find that problematic, sure. or at least, you know, regrettable that mm-hmm. we use those terms, because there's nothing special. It's not special treatment. It's not asking for something extra that they don't deserve. This is what the law requires. And the law requires these services based on our communal recognition that this is a basic right. This is a basic human need. And for a parent to approach a school and say no more, no less than, I'm expecting you to provide a free and appropriate public education, because of course, that's what our country on a very basic level expects and demands and requires of you. It's astounding that schools' response isn't, oh, of course.
Yeah.
Right. That should be their first answer. Instead, all too often, the response is, well, exactly what do you mean by that? Or, well, we're doing our best. Well, maybe you should go somewhere else. Mm. Maybe you should spend more money. And that's not what the law requires. That's not what we as a society have come to expect. So I think parents should, A, turn to, as you've mentioned, the experts, turn to whether it's clinics, whether it's law firms that do pro bono work, or whether it's special education attorneys who are really skilled, who are ready to fight when necessary, who have that attitude of looking out for the best interests of your child, of the student. And at the same time, going with the mindset that you're not asking for something special. You're not asking for special treatment on the part of the school. Even though we call it special education, again, I don't know if we're going to change that anytime soon. But it doesn't mean special in the sense that, oh, you're getting something you don't deserve. You're getting what you deserve, what your child requires, and what your child is supposed to be getting. Not asking for anything beyond that.
So I have an interesting question. And, you know, oftentimes I'll share, you know, personal things that are applicable to conversations, especially for our family. One thing I want to know, maybe your opinion is twice exceptional children, mm-hmm. children who learn academically at a much faster excelled rate of, you know, learning. And this is why at when we got, my son has a photographic memory and was reading at one and writing at two. He was nonverbal till he was four, but we wrote back and forth to one another. And at one point we realized he had a photographic memory. When he started preschool and such, they had amazing programs that they were willing to just work with him where he was at, which was exciting for everyone, right? I mean, it's just really exciting for adults when a child has really high, you know, learning abilities and you can really challenge them and, you know, do fun things. But first grade turned out to be the beginning of the end of our education. And they basically just said, we can't teach him at the level he's at. There's just no, we don't offer algebra for first graders. Sorry. You know, and we did end up homeschooling for 6 years. And even me with the knowledge and experience in law, I didn't go and find an attorney. I didn't go fight the school. And you know, it's hard. Sometimes I feel a little bit regretful for that purpose and that I maybe should have. And I still have the opportunity. He's only 13. I could still, you know, go and try to get some more education for him. At the same time, it really caused some disheartening for me in the school system and how that could be addressed. But here I am still trying to help, you know, all of these other families and things and saying, it didn't work for us. And I can't tell you that there's this great way to go about it. But what's your opinion on those kinds of
Those are great questions. Thank you for sharing that experience. Yeah. And, you know, when we talk about twice exceptional, and I believe in your case as well, and you know, one of your areas of expertise is specifically, you know, autism, and that's also an area that our Disability Rights and Inclusion Program has focused on, as it turns out, for many of the same reasons I think that you've been focusing. You have that personal connection, it sounds like, as well, but also because autism has become such a common diagnosis, I guess we can say, and it's become well known as a condition, however you characterize it, whatever you describe it as, a reality for many children and their parents trying to navigate the school district. And twice exceptional in the sense that, without stereotyping, you know, we do have to kind of generalize. And when it comes to autism, there are those categories or forms or manifestations, presentations of autism, where you have a child who's twice exceptional, where they are advanced academically, but there's other areas, whether they're kind of social, emotional, yes, behavioral, as they're called, areas where they have challenges, and the school system has the obligation to educate those children as well. The law doesn't say unless they're different.
Yeah.
Unless they're exceptional or twice exceptional. Well, in that case, you can just throw in the, yeah, that's not how it works.
Yeah.
And again, I don't want to give too much precise legal advice because it's not my area as an expertise, but I've been involved in enough of these cases where the law is that the school has to provide and has to find the setting where your child can be educated. So their answer can't be, we don't know what to do with this child. And it's often is, whether it's first grade or sometimes, you know, we often ask parents that question, when was it? What was the time? As you, and you said first grade, sometimes it's third grade, sometimes, you know, fourth. I think it's sort of the middle school is really challenging if you can get that far as a worker, because then a lot of those social issues really do come into play even more so, although they can be there in kindergarten and first grade and such. So the school has the obligation. If you can't educate this child within your system, then find a place that can. In a nutshell, that is their obligation. And for them to say, we can't, we don't know what to do, they're essentially admitting that they're breaking the law, that they're not following the mandate that they have. Now, again, I respect your decision and your approach, because there are many areas of law where, and it comes in particular in areas of discrimination, which is what this is, areas of really just human rights and social justice, where individuals in power don't always comply with the law. Again, you have a big surprise there, right?
So
when it comes to that type of area, you kind of, on the one hand, you want to assert your rights and you should feel comfortable asserting your rights, but most of all, you care about your child. And if you're going to keep fighting and it's not going to get you anywhere, if the school is not going to make a good faith effort to educate your child, or they'll find a different placement that's not appropriate, then sometimes parents, and again, this is not the way it should be, but sometimes parents make that calculation and that decision. Well, what are my choices? And if my best choice of bad choices or less ideal, less than ideal choices, if my best choice is to homeschool my child, I'm going to go ahead, and at least I know that I'm providing the best possible setting within the realistic opportunities that are available to me. It's not, again, it's not the way we it should be, but we live in the real world, and we recognize that we can't always get what we deserve under the law.
And, you know, it due to my probably experience of being a paralegal and understanding what research takes and how to go about doing it, I was able to find an amazing online school where the curriculum was there, the IEP was in place, he was able to get speech therapy and, you know, reading, he didn't need help with reading, but rather just, you know, kind of social skills, tutoring things. And it's been amazing. We've basically phased out of high school at the age of 12. So now we're on to new things. We'll have to catch up after this and find out what I do next.
Exactly. Well, you know, it's funny because you mentioned your background as a paralegal and your experience in the law. And of all things, that might have given you a better appreciation for the limits of the law.
Yeah,
and exactly. I say this as a law professor as well. I've surprised you or some of your listeners. Oh, I thought he was going to talk about IEPs and 504s and stuff. And you know what? As a lawyer and a law professor, I'm actually more familiar with the limits, and they're all important. The laws are important. The statutes are important. And we should assert those rights when they're available and when they're appropriate and effective. But what I think I've learned more, and that's why I've established and the title of the Disability Rights and Inclusion Project, is really aimed at that understanding that rights are central, rights are important. They're there, at least on the books. But to me, the real progress, the recognition of the strengths and the potential for your child, for twice exceptional, for autism, for anyone who needs supports, for individuals with whatever disability, who need structures, who need supports, who need, we call them accommodations. But you know what? Society has to recognize the goal of inclusion. It's not a matter of begrudgingly saying, okay, you have this right, and I'm obligated under the law to give you this and to give you that. And you know what? I'll do it kicking and screaming. I'll fight you. But if you win, I'll give it to you. That's not really going to get us anywhere. Mm-hmm. So the idea of inclusion, where, again, sort of the whole mindset is switched, where we see a child in the school system and our first question is not, oh, what do we have to do? What are they going to force us? What can we avoid doing? Our first question should be, how can we include that child? Mm-hmm. And it sounds simple, but it really does take a switch in the mindset, the idea that the goal is inclusion and the rights are still there. The legal rights are in the background on some level. There may be at the base of the efforts, but the goal is going to be inclusion.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And it's so important that we do this. The future of our nation, the future of our world, we want to build a community where we're working together and not against. We've worked against. We understand what that looks like. The majority of us, I think, don't want to work against one another in those types of ways. So yeah, get our mindsets in the right place where we're working together. I think that that's really great advice to everyone, right? To just kind of have the, in the forefront of your mind, what's the best we can do as a human society to better our community and our future, because those kids, they're going to be the president and the lawyers and the teachers and the district leaders. And what we teach them now and the examples we give them now are the traits that they're going to enact when they're in those positions.
Absolutely. And I hate to say it, but you know, if a child's excluded because they're different, you've not only damaged that child and their family, you've damaged all the children in that child's class who get the message, oh, they're different, so they can't be along with us, so we can't include them. And what message does that send to those children as they grow up and as they become adults and as it becomes their responsibility? Their first reaction, and this may be conscious, this may be subconscious, but the implicit bias that we talk about in a number of different areas, where their first instinctive reaction will be, that person's different. Maybe we'll make minimal efforts to include them, but if it's too much, if it's too difficult for us, then our response is going to be exclude them, or worse. I mean, putting aside the bullying, the isolation, the ostracization, that, you know, and that should go without saying, though unfortunately, that's obviously present as well. But the message, the very direct message that we're sending, is that, well, when someone's different, it's not worth our time. It's not worth our effort. And that's a truly tragic result.
Yeah, I agree 100%. In fact, I don't know why this flashed in my mind. Just at the grocery store last night, and you know, my son has unfortunately had a little meltdown. And he's very small, but he's 13. He's going to get bigger. He's getting older. And he hasn't quite he doesn't have the restraint not to hit when he's in a meltdown right now. Mm-hmm. We're still working on those skills. And so, you know, unfortunately you have the people all around that are going to look and stare. And I personally am out in the world with him a lot. And I've learned how to either communicate with those people right away. Hey, this is autism. Like, support us. That's what we need right now. But my husband, on the other hand, being the protector and the provider and all of those things, doesn't quite want that, you know, in the environment when we're out. And so, just yesterday, we had that exact situation where it's like the people that work at that grocery store, they know us. They let me include him in everything, checking out all the groceries, doing all right. The things, you know, and they're so wonderful. They talk to him, engage with him, but it's the bystanders. It's the bystanders who just are, you know, they're shopping. That once we know in our society, once, like you said, autism is a growing number, 1 in 44 kids right now in the US. And that number is tripling, doubling, quadrupling in very fast, you know, increases. So people are going to have to know about it. And it's in our face now. It's going to really be in our face then. And the better we can just normalize what those actions look like, normalize what families look like supporting other families. Brilliant, right? That's what we need.
I think so. And I think starting from the educational process and what we've been working toward, actually, the other part of the project, and this is in, I guess, your future as a family personally, is the employment process.
Yes.
Because, you know, as I mentioned before, as you well know, as challenging as the educational process can be, and that stage of life, the key to 12 or till age of 21, as we're now finding more and more with autism, as autism is becoming better understood, more normalized, which it is, among society, and better understood among adults,
yeah,
who recognize that although they were not diagnosed 20 years ago or 30 years ago, because we didn't have the type of awareness that we do now, they recognize that they are on the autism spectrum, and they haven't had the support while they were in school and certainly when they're out of school. So what do we do to provide those supports, whether it's employment, whether it's independent living, for individuals once they've aged out of the system? So some of the programs we've now been putting on have to do with autism and employment. Mm-hmm. That question of what happens next, and it's next for, you know, your children, it's now for countless individuals, yeah, who over the years have been unemployed, underemployed, marginalized, whether they were marginalized in school as children, now they're marginalized at work. And whether, you know, there's obstacles to getting the job, to retention, to promotion, and the work environment that has somehow become the norm is not always a healthy one.
Yeah.
You know, we talked about lawyers, and one thing that I'm very sensitive to for my students is that when they enter the law firms, now the law firm environment can be challenging as well. You've worked at law firms as a paralegal. You've probably seen the good, the bad, and the ugly.
I was the face of plenty of them, actually. So yes, the first person you walk in the door, you know, that can be a good and a bad thing.
Absolutely. So that's really important. And some of the very same social challenges that we see in the schoolyard in those unstructured times in particular, well, that's going to happen at the office as well.
Yeah.
And that's an area where I think we're achieving a growing awareness, and part of our project is directed toward addressing those issues.
That's wonderful. Where can we send people to, especially if they're in Long Island and they're interested in law, or they're students already, or they're, you know, just want to find out more? Where can we send them to find out more information about what you're doing and how to get in touch with you?
So feel free to check our website. You know, it's Touro Law School, T-O-U-R-O, And you can find our Disability Rights and Inclusion Program on the website. And you'll see we've actually recorded many of our programs over the years, both special education program and, as I mentioned more recently, autism and employment programs. We've also established, and I think this is something I'm kind of optimistic about on the higher education level, we recently established a student organization called DALSA, Disabled and Allied Law Students Association. And it's very common over the years at colleges and at law schools to have student groups in all different areas, right? There's different student interest groups. So there's been a growing awareness of disability rights and inclusion and a growing number of chapters of this national DALSA, Disabled and Allied Law Students Association. And we just established a chapter at Turo. So I was actually overwhelmed by the response. A student of mine decided to establish a chapter to just, you know, try it, and spoke to a bunch of the students in his class. And about 7 or 8 students right away decided to join up. And many, not all, but I would say most of the students have had some experience, either personally for themselves or family members or friends of theirs who have disabilities, who have lived with disabilities and who have faced, I call it discrimination, because that's what it is, as a result of their disabilities. And I'm optimistic by the response that we've gotten so far at Turo. And I've seen this happening at other schools around the New York area. And I know that there are schools that are across the country who likewise have these types of organizations. And as you said, you know, the current students, these are going to be the leaders. And these are the students who are going to be running the law firms and hiring the lawyers and training future lawyers. They're going to be the next judges and, you know, as you said, presidents. So it's really important to teach them and to develop this awareness at this stage in their life and in their career, so that as they move on and move up to different positions of leadership, they'll be able to take those lessons forward.
Yeah, absolutely. It's been such a great conversation with you today. I really appreciate your time, your knowledge, and I look forward to staying in touch with you and catching up to see what's going on over there at Tour Law.
Thank you so much, Sarah. It's a real pleasure to speak with you today.
Absolutely. Thank you so much. We'll definitely be in touch.